This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Taya Obrett, author of the novel The Morningside.
I think that's the piece of craft advice that I carry with me to this day, you know, and I think it informs so many of the decisions that I make on the page. This idea of like, this has to matter to someone in the story. The fact that it's being told, it can't matter to you, it can't matter to the reader, it has to matter to someone who's there in that world. Who is that person and why?
We'll be back with Taya Obrett after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it, because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote-unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Taya Abrett, author of the international bestseller, The Tiger's Wife, which won the 2011 Orange Prize for Fiction and was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her second novel, Inland, won the Southwest Book Award and was a finalist for the Dylan Thomas Prize. Her work has appeared in the Best American Short Stories, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Harper's, among other publications. Her new novel, The Morningside, tells the story of 11-year-old Sylvia, who, along with her mother, moved to the Morningside, a crumbling luxury tower in a place called Island City, where Sylvia's aunt, Enna, works as the superintendent. The novel takes place in a not-so-distant future where the once vibrant Island City is half underwater and Sylvia and her family are refugees, having been expelled from their ancestral home. While Sylvia's mother will share little about their homeland and Sylvia's youth, Enna offers folktales and stories from back home that ignite Sylvia's imagination. These tales enchant Sylvia, and she begins to see magical possibilities in the world around her, particularly becoming obsessed with an older wealthy woman who lives in the Morningside. We began the discussion with me asking Taya Abrett this question. You know, in the very beginning, your editor writes about this time when you wrote this, which was you were in the midst of pregnancy and the pandemic, and it felt like maybe like a fever dream. And so I wanted to ask you, like, what you were feeling in, like, in your body and how that translated to this story.
That's a great question. And fever dream, I think, is completely accurate. I've never written something where my awareness of it was so fragmented between drafts. So I wrote the first draft during the pandemic, the second draft during pregnancy, and the third draft when I was a new mom, which was the haziest of all. But I think, yeah, the bodily feeling of it, that's such an interesting question. I think it felt very, I felt very sort of dark and closed off, if that makes sense. And as I was writing this book, usually I like to start a project when I have a bit more clarity. And the way I often feel is that I'm moving through a project in the dark. I have a beam of light. And before I start, I like that beam to be as large as possible. I like it to encompass as much of the area around me as I can get it to. So that's what, you know, all the research is about, and kind of reading books with a similar bent, or reading books that are nothing like it. And in this case, I just sort of started. So the beam was very, very small. And the feeling was one of intense claustrophobia and of kind of trying to see more, feeling very agitated that I couldn't see more as I was moving through. And I think when I read the book now, I think that feeling really translated into it somehow. I don't know. And this is sort of a strange process, right? Like, you know, I don't know where it comes from, but I know it's there. And I don't know how it's working on the page, but I can feel it. And yeah, that was the feeling. That was the bodily feeling.
I think it feels sort of like that to read it. And, you know, as you were talking about that, I was thinking, like, how do you, I mean, you're a teacher, so I didn't even know how you would begin to teach that. But it's almost like a more perplexing thing than voice is how a book feels. Like, how would you talk about that?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. I've talked about it a few times in different, I'm trying to think now of examples where I've talked about these kinds of situations with students. I'm thinking of one student in particular whose short stories were sort of all feeling. And then that feeling was the thing that bound the story together. Like it's events and other disparate elements didn't work. And so but the feeling did, and the feeling carried through. And so what I would say to her, it would be like, the question that you asked me, like, how would you describe this? Like, what do you think is going on emotionally here under the surface? How does this feel? And how do you, you know, like, is this the correct language to translate that feeling to another person? Like, if I'm trying to invite somebody else into an emotional or psychological experience, what are the most precise mechanisms of language to trigger that feeling in the other person? Can you do that? Like, is this the right word to achieve that? And I think, I think it's a negotiation of like really granular stuff of, you know, minutia in every sentence, if you can, and sort of cutting off sentences before they reveal too much, and sort of keeping the reader off balance, trying to achieve a feeling of disbalance. So that's how I would talk about it, I think.
I guess it's a little bit like tone, but it's something else because it's like the corporeal experience of reading that in a way makes a book, any book, but this book for me feels so intimate. Like I can maybe talk about it with you or someone else who read it on an intellectual level, and we could talk about the theme and the craft, but I think we're so alone in our lives and our bodies that there's also something just so personal when you experience something in your body like that, which is how you started.
Yeah, I agree. And it's so fascinating and really gratifying to hear that's the experience then of reading the book, because, you know, you finish the book, it goes out into the world, every reader has their own personal experience with it, and you sort of hope that there's a universality that they'll be able to follow, right? This notion of like, well, this is a dramatic moment, you will feel anxiety, you know. But this ended up being a deeply personal book, I think, in that feeling of isolation and, you know, in interiority, and I'm still, I think, learning how to talk about it, probably for that reason. You know, I think you're highlighting this for me right now as we're talking about it. And so to know that you felt sort of similarly wedged in by this world is wonderful. And thank you.
Well, how did the pandemic, like the feeling you had at the beginning when you started in this maybe feverish, dreamy state, translate into something that was more climactic? Because this is, I mean, like climate related, that this is kind of a post climate catastrophe world where they're living is basically most of it is underwater. And, you know, we can talk about the details, but first, like, how did that be the theme for you and the setting?
Two things happened. One was I found myself as the pandemic kicked off, I found myself kind of, isolated in a way by the fact that people around me, the people in my life, seemed surprised. And it was very, I mean, obviously it was a surprising moment. It was in many ways a world altering moment. We still have not recovered. There are so many elements of society that were touched by this. And I'm someone who suffers from OCD, from intense anxiety, particularly, having to do with germs. And I was surprised at my own reaction, the fact that I felt so prepared. And I tried to think about where that had come from. And I think the answer was, I'm realizing now, or I realized at some point while writing the book, that the answer was that I had been raised, you know, by people who had suffered a society ending event, you know, not ending, but altering, like society altering event. They were born and they lived and they were culturally of a nation that in which they believed, which ceased to exist. And because they were, you know, because the lines of splintering were ethnic, and my family was mixed, I think there was a huge sense of loss because what they believed in was that those ethnicities did not matter, that those differences did not matter. You know, my grandmother was Muslim, my grandfather was Roman Catholic, but they were first and foremost Yugoslavs. They married. There was no cultural issue with that. You know, and when the country fell apart, their sense of displacement, their sense of heartbreak, their sense of loss, it was really intense. They tried to hide it from me, but they were lost. And the feeling that I was raised with, which I'm sure they didn't intend, was that this kind of event was inevitable and that another one was coming, that something else like this was sort of pursuing you around the corners of your life, and that notions of a certain kind of stability weren't real. And so when the pandemic hit and you know, there were sort of these recognizable signs of a kind of, you know, life during wartime, you know, where will the resources come from? Are we safe? Are our institutions going to hold? These things felt really familiar, and I felt prepared. and that was sort of shocking to realize that and kind of live in it. So that was, you know, I think that was hugely instrumental to how the book came about. We lived next door for a really long time. We were living in New York next to the Jewish seminary, which a few years before the pandemic tore down one of its buildings and sold part of the complex to a developer who was building this monster luxury tower there. And it was completed kind of right as the pandemic kicked off. And I remember thinking, building a building, what an act of confidence that is in your society, you know, what an act of like faith in your institutions and the fact that the things that bring order and financial stability will continue as they are. And, you know, and that building was something that I'd been watching go up for years and years. And I think it those two things coalesced for me, and the story pulled out of that, you know, this idea of like, well, what would it be like if people were living in a tower like this, but 80 years from now, right? And instead of recovering, quote unquote, from a world-ending event, the community around it had just continued into a slow, devastating slide into incompetence and bureaucratic snarls and a continuation of sort of the injustices that already persist in our society. Like, what would this moment look like, but 80 years from now? And I think those are the things that the book kind of came out of. And I didn't want it to be, you know, this one cataclysmic event. I wanted it to be the background of everything, but that it had just sort of been a kind of a slow snowballing of all the things that we're seeing, right? And that's, you know, that's where they find themselves at the beginning of the book, just sort of in this waterlogged world in a luxury tower that is slowly crumbling.
Do you think that what you were saying about like the way you grew up with your grandparents and like the destabilizing nature of their country falling apart and your sort of calm at the pandemic, that having that in your personal history, it's kind of like, okay, here we go again. Like there's just like some acceptance, like you're more in a way that you're just more resilient in a way that almost would like flaunt some therapist that would say, it's okay, you're safe, it's everything's fine. And then the pandemic comes and you're like, see?
Yes, for sure. But there was such, I think that there was such relief in that for me. And this is such a horrible thing to say. It was like, see, I was right. Yes, absolutely. It's just around the corner and here it is. Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, I'd like to think that the therapy can help make you more resilient when it happens, that it isn't necessarily about it not happening again. It's how you deal with it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, I think one of the things that you I don't think I'm a particularly resilient person in general. I think in many, many ways I'm quite fragile. But I do think that for my own, for my particular form of anxiety, it's always been sort of based on, you know, signs and symbols and a kind of narrativization of inevitability and precisely what you're talking about, you know, this idea that something's coming. And then it came, right? And my whole thing in therapy is always like, well, probably nothing's coming. Like you're catastrophizing. It's like, well, here it is. Here's the catastrophe. Quite possibly there's a feeling in that moment of catastrophe of a pushing of the reset button. You know, you sort of restart the clock and you're like, well, now we wait for the next one. But like, maybe there's some time. Like here we are in the catastrophe. Now we're waiting for the next one, but time is, you know, we have some time until it materializes. And on some level, I think that feeling is a relief, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You're like patient one, therapist zero.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically, this isn't sort of the after times of major catastrophe, but like you were saying, a slow onset of climate refugees where this city called Island City is underwater and your protagonist is an 11-year-old named Sylvia and she and her mother come to this country, I'm assuming is America, to live with her aunt who's a superintendent of this very fancy building and her aunt's name is Anna and they come to live with her and they are part of something called the repopulation program and there's posterity initiatives going on and Sylvia, who you call Sil, she can't go to school. And so she's the only child in this world. There's no other kids living in the building. They have a playroom, but there's no one for her to play with. So she's kind of thrust into this adult world and she sneaks into apartments and she's watching what's happening around her. And she also lives through story. There's a woman who lives on the top floor named Bessie Duras and she has three dogs. And Anna tells Sil that the dogs aren't quite dogs, that they actually might turn into people, but she doesn't tell her more. So she's captivated by this story and she's trying to figure out the veracity of it and spends time spying on Bessie and following her. And in the meanwhile, her mom takes over her aunt's job. She also works as a wreck diver going underwater to look for treasures in buried buildings. And then Sil meets this young girl named Mila who moves in, who is her age and very precocious and kind of more of a leader, but in a bullying way. And she brings her aunt into her story about Bessie and they end up following her around. And so it's this search for trying to find answers to things and I guess like you, Sil is very superstitious. She believes in omens and signs and talisman. And so the story is really about, it's really her coming of age, but it's also so much about storytelling and how we process trauma. One of the things I'm really wondering about is sort of the relationship to trauma and telling stories and that as children, if we need bigger explanations than the most sensible one, if rather than Occam's razor, we need to create new worlds and fantasies to make sense of the world. So do kids need more than reality? Let's start there.
I think in my experience, I think some do. And I think that comes from, to some extent, I think we have a real tendency to withhold information from children, right? Like they don't have context for a lot of things. As we grow older, I think we have less and less of a need. Many of us have less and less of a need for those fantastical fillers because our sense of context becomes greater, right? We understand, you know, histories, and realities outside of the microcosm of ourselves, right? Like the children inhabit this very, very small space. And in order for them to, and they're information gathering all the time about everything. And where they don't have information, they sort of, I'm even watching my toddler, she's not even two yet, but I'm watching her sort of piece together. Like if she doesn't have an answer for something, she won't necessarily wait for me to give it to her. She'll just make it up, right? And I think that that is a hugely resilient trait in humans, the fact that, you know, this sort of resourcefulness of information. Of course, as we get older, it can be manipulated in terrifying ways and lead to all kinds of horrible disasters, social, psychological, and other. But I think in Syl's case, yeah, it is this sense of trying to gather as much information as she can. Her mother is extremely resistant to sharing intelligence and giving context. And she, where she lacks it, she'll take what she can get. I do think that's a process of childhood. And as we get older, we become more skilled at using actual information to narrativize, even when we're narrativizing.
But I also think that there's an element of the adults that maybe it's just playful, but Enna, her aunt, fed her these stories. She gave her these maybe folktale-ish like answers to questions. And in some ways, I could see how it's just lightening the heaviness of what they'd been through and where they were. And also, it seems to me another way to deal with trauma for adults.
I agree. And I think that there's a kind of reclamation of identity that happens. And I've certainly seen it in my own family, where when you become separated from your culture or from other members of your family or other people who share your stories, you become the only carrier of them. And there's a kind of territoriality and ownership that happens. And I think that manifests in Enna as a necessary belief in the things she's saying. I think she's being playful, but I think she's also growing her own belief as she tells these stories to Syl, because there's no one to challenge them, right? Like there's no existent community or reality that puts a check on that. And as a result, the stories themselves become a mechanism of survival and a mechanism of resilience, and they can't be challenged. And they become a manifestation of this reality that she maybe wishes were the case. And so they become real.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Is it strange at all to talk about it with this sort of analysis when you were perhaps writing it in a more feverish creative state because it is so folktale-ish?
Totally. It's been very strange trying to gather my thoughts about it, specifically for that reason. I mean, you said it. Yes, it is very strange. I think talking about this book has forced me to contend with my subconscious beliefs about the nature of belief and the relationship between adults and children, and what adults owe children, and then also, you know, what adults owe the next generation, and then also what the next generation owes the people who dragged them into survival at any cost. It's a challenging thing to process in language and an analysis, for sure.
Yeah, because I think the creative process is sometimes these things just come out of you, and then there's someone like me saying, well, what is this about this? And you kind of could see, well, yeah, maybe, but it just came out of me.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's, but I also think it's really fascinating for me, particularly with this book, to see the connections that readers are making and be like, oh my God, yes, of course, that makes total sense. You know, like it's a revelation to me as well. Because I think on, in so many ways, because of that haze we were talking about, because the beam of light was so very small, my work on it was granular, right? Like I wrote this messy first draft that was like, well, here are these inhabitants of this building, you know, here's May and he's working on, you know, he's working on something else in his life and he's connected to this in some way. And, you know, there's a party and I'm trying not to give away too many spoilers. And then this sort of third act character who, you know, and it was messy, 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 messy. And then sort of trying to make these pieces flow into one another through granular attention to language and movement through the plot, to the point where I think that this is the first time I'm very late in the process sort of looking up to see the big picture. And so when it's sort of pointed out, it's kind of this other layer of realization, like, oh, well, there it is. Oh yeah. Oh, well, that's fun. That's fantastic.
My experience as a reader, because when the book opens, there's kind of a prologue. I mean, it's not labeled. That's very, it's kind of watery and hazy. And this woman, Sill, is older. She's at a train station and she's kind of mentioning what happened in the past, but you don't know who any of these people are yet. So she's using names and she's using, I think, you know, some of the terms of the repopulation program might be in that section. It's just like three pages and it's kind of destabilizing for the reader, but obviously they also want to read because they want to learn, well, who is this person and what was this case and what is the mystery here? And I'm curious if that came first or later, and also craft-wise, how you think that works as a writer or for the reader, and how do you not, I don't mean justify it, like, of course, it's allowed to belong, but how do you unfold it? Like, are you thinking about that when you're writing?
It's a great question. That came, I think, in the second draft or towards the end of the second draft. I set out to write this book entirely chronologically, which has never happened before. I have a tendency to, I think probably because so much of my preoccupation, my subconscious preoccupation, has to do with storytelling itself and how it works and how people create meaning out of stories. There's a tendency in my work to fold time so that people in different spaces on the timeline can create meaning for themselves out of the stories that came before. And I really, really, really didn't want to do that. I wanted to go straight through the storyline and you know, create the meaning as it went on. And as I wrote that first draft, it was there was something about it that was kind of rough and unkind to Sill, and it didn't do the thing that I wanted it to do. It didn't have the emotional effect. And I realized that I needed a prologue, that I was going to have to smash this idea of, you know, of total linearity in order to be able to introduce Sill as an older person, because, you know, by the end of the book, we do arrive to Sill as an older person. And that came as a surprise in the first draft. I was like, oh, we're going beyond. We're going into the future now. And she's in a different phase of her life. As that became the ending of the first draft, it became clear to me that this slightly more tender lens, which didn't sneer at its younger self, you know, was going to have to be there to kind of marshal the emotional entry point into the book. It was going to have to be tender towards this young person who was struggling. Otherwise, the ability to sneer at her as she makes her way through this new world was really, really quite strong. So I put it in as a kind of ballast for myself. And then it worked. And I think it balanced the whole book out in a way that I really, really liked, because I had told myself then, like, if it works just to do this to me as I write the book, I'll take it out at the end. Like if it's not necessary as a component of the whole narrative, I'll take it out. I think that's really true. I find that to be something that happens to me in craft often, and to some of my students as well. This idea of putting in something artificial that is a check on yourself that then inherently has to become part of the narrative, because then it's like, well, where does this voice come from? Where is this tenderness coming from? Like it, I remember being in a workshop with the great short story writer, Stephanie Vaughn, and turning in a very early draft of the first, you know, couple of chapters of The Tiger's Wife, and her saying, who does it matter to? It has to matter to somebody. And I remember that was one of the, I think that's the piece of craft advice that I carry with me to this day, you know, and I think it informs so many of the decisions that I make on the page, this idea of like, this has to matter to someone in the story. The fact that it's being told, it can't matter to you, it can't matter to the reader, it has to matter to someone who's there in that world. Who is that person and why? And that's usually a question that gets answered for me somewhere around the second draft.
It seems like too, you, there is some trust you have to put in your readers. And I don't know if you need more of that when you're writing about a world that doesn't yet exist, this, you know, drowned world. But, you know, when you mention things like the repopulation program, like you don't explain what it is until later in the book, and you just have to trust that your reader's going to come along. And I think having that trust is really important, because I don't think it's helpful to just explain everything in some didactic way when you're introducing all these new concepts in a something that's speculative.
I have enormous respect for people who can world build on such an incredibly granular level. Sort of, I can do it informatively, effectively, and affectingly all at the same time, right? Like, I think there's so much in sci-fi and fantasy that does have to be explained. And there are readers out there who live for that kind of world building, like they really do. And I've never been that reader, kind of because I can barely figure out how things work in this world. And that was sort of the approach that felt the most comfortable to me, this idea of like, well, this is a child. She's been told about these things. She's gathered some information about what they are. She has some faith that they work. But actually, part of what's contributing to the state of the world is the fact that they're opaque, and is the fact that like people can't quite access all the information that is necessary about them. And that's kind of, you know, kind of why it's a big failing system in many of the ways that like so many systems in our world are big failing systems, because they're completely, you know, opaque and convoluted and contradictory and all these things. So I decided to put the reader in line with Syl, hoping that her rudimentary understanding of it would be enough. And I think you're totally right. Like, I think you have to trust the reader to continue with you, right? Like to take your hand and be like, okay, we're doing this way. I do think that this book, more than anything else I've ever written, asks that of the reader. But I also hope that Syl is a character whose curiosity is just enough to bring the reader through without really missing anything, without them missing these parts that she can't see.
And what about continuing on with kind of a structural question? You separate it into four books, and the books are the characters. So you have Anna, Bessie Duras, Mila, and then her mother. But it's still all really through Syl. So I'm curious if this also came later as a way to help you organize it, or if that was something that just naturally came out as you wrote the first draft.
That definitely came later. Almost all my organizing principles sort of come like toward the end of the second or the beginning of the third draft. I realized that Syl was emotionally focused in each of the books on a different woman in her life, on a different entity in her life. And it seemed really important. And actually, a reader of mine pointed it out too, was like, you realize that this book features the stories and fates of these for women in Syl's life. And I was like, yeah, well, now that you pointed out, yes, I do. and then it became a way to reorganize the book, not just by chronology, but also emotional intent, emotional focus, right? Like she's pulled in all these different directions. She has these different allegiances and impulses toward relationships with these four people who are at odds with each other. And yeah, that came later.
You know, we don't live in a world that's ever going to be the same. I mean, the temperature is rising. Like when you talk about climate change, like you are not giving the same world to your daughter that we have, and every day is different. And you have a part at the end, like you were saying, the climate change is, it's the backdrop, but it's never really the focus. It's the setting, it's the circumstances, but it's not really front and center. Like it is climate change fiction, but it's also really not. I would say. Yeah. But at the end, you have this beautiful paragraph where you're talking about the debt that is owed to our children, really. And I'm curious about feeling that when you have a child now that, you know, the mother says, I realized that I'd brought you into life at a time when everyone else's debts had come due. And that's the world we live in now, but it's not really the world that we lived in when we were children.
Yeah. I think that scene has been virtually unchanged, apart from a few small lines from the very, very first draft. I think it was, to me, one of the primary indicators that the book had worked up until that point, that first draft was right. Because I knew when I sat down to write the scene, I wrote it in one day, Syl and her mother, I knew that they were going to talk and that Syl was going to confess to her mother all the things that had been going on during that time in their lives. And this is the sort of strange thing that's happening at this time of life with myself and a lot of my friends. It's like, are your parents just sort of suddenly like opening the floodgates? Like, are they just suddenly telling you all the things that were like really screened from you in the past? I was like, yeah, they really are. You know, like suddenly you've aged into the right to know, right? Like their emotional condition and like all these terrifying things that they hid from you. And so I think that it became this quite natural moment between Syl and her mother that was the product of the rest of the book's cogs all kind of clicking at the same time. And that moment, I think, when Syl's mother tells her, I realize that like the things that I know aren't going to work for you, like they're just not going to work. I find myself wondering whether that's a feeling that is reserved for parents of the generation that is now sort of in this transitional point of the changing of the world, right? Like, because I think there were a couple of generations in which people were, you know, we had like we'd brought down empire, we'd quote unquote brought down empire, and now we were in this phase of democracy and or you know, ineffective socialism, depending on where we grew up. And now there was going to be this thing where like you were a member of society, were a contributing member of society, you went to school, you studied in college, and the fate intended for you was more or less the kind of thing that was legible to your parents. And there were a couple of generations like that. And I think that we are now entering a phase of the world where parents quite openly have to say to their kids, I don't know what's in store for you. Like, I really don't. So that space that Syl's mom inhabits, I think is unique to her generation, even though obviously even though the book is set in the future, I think it's unique to the generation that she represents, right? Like this, at least now we know about the unknowing, right? Like at least now we know that we're not equipped. Like I find a tremendous sense of relief in knowing that the things that I have to say to my daughter, to my children, if we're lucky enough to have a second, is, you know, I really don't know. Get ready in every way you can. I, you know, we have failed you. So the things that applied to me, they're not going to apply to you. And they're probably not going to apply to me in a later phase of life either, you know, quite frankly. I think that was a moment of a strange blending of feeling and character, if that makes sense.
And I think it just brings us back to this idea that we were talking about in the beginning. It's like stability. That's, as a parent, I think that's like one of the things your children need the most. And it's actually the thing we should never promise them. In this world, right, where the climate is changing, where the country, right, that you're born in doesn't exist anymore. Like, it's like one of the ultimate paradoxes in a way. Like, everyone says like kids need this certainty, and there isn't any.
I mean, you know, have a look at the world in this moment, and you know, the things that are happening all around it. We are in an apocalyptic time in the West. This also goes back to sort of what we were talking about earlier. In the West, we have this fascination with apocalypse fiction and this idea that when it comes, whatever it is, it will be a world ender, as in it will end the whole world. What it really means, and sort of the subtext of Western fiction, is it will end our world, because our world is built on stability and sort of these huge, you know, seemingly immovable capitalist systems that are meant to protect us. I remember Brian Turner, the poet Brian Turner, giving a talk at Columbia many years ago. And we lived in the neighborhood, and we went, and he, you know, he said, "Do you realize that you live," he said to the students, they were mostly undergrads, "do you realize that you live in a country that has been at war for your entire lives? You've never seen it. Unless you're an army family, you've never seen it. It's never touched your life. That's how rich this country is." That's what he said. And they were staggered, you know, but it's true, right? Like, apocalypse is only apocalypse if it comes here. Whereas apocalypses are happening at this moment, every day, all over the world, in different arenas. You know, societies are ending. People's lives are at risk. People don't dare say to their children, "You'll grow up." And that is a reality in which we've lived for a really long time. And some people have lived in it way more than others. You know, it's there and it's been there.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Can you read something that influences you as a writer?
So this is a passage from Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And the setup is, Fermina Daza is from a wealthy family. She's a teenage schoolgirl when Florentino Ariza, who's a young man of low birth, spots and falls in love with her. And the two of them begin a passionate correspondence that's cut off by her father, who sends her away to try to break up the affair. But of course, the absence only intensifies it. And by the time we get to this passage, she has returned to the city of her birth, and she and Florentino Ariza are planning to wed. And her ailing father has sort of promoted her to woman of the house. And he tells her, "I give you the keys to your life." And she goes out into the marketplace. And Florentino, who hasn't seen her in years, is following her. So here's a little bit of that chapter. Fermina Daza shared with her schoolmates the singular idea that the arcade of the scribes was a place of perdition that was forbidden, of course, to decent young ladies. It was an arcaded gallery across from a little plaza where carriages and freight cars drawn by donkeys were for hire, where popular commerce became noisier and more dense. The name dated from colonial times, when the taciturn scribes in their vests and false cuffs first began to sit there, waiting for a poor man's fee to write all kinds of documents, memoranda of complaints or petition, legal testimony, cards of congratulation or condolence, love letters appropriate to any stage in an affair. They, of course, were not the ones who had given that thundering market its bad reputation, but more recent peddlers who made illegal sales of all kinds of questionable merchandise smuggled in on European ships, from obscene postcards and aphrodisiac ointments to the famous Catalonian condoms with iguana crests that fluttered when circumstances required, or with flowers at the tip that would open their petals at the will of the user. Fermina Daza, somewhat unskilled in the customs of the street, went through the arcade without noticing where she was going as she searched for a shady refuge from the fierce 11 o'clock sun. She sank into the hot clamor of the shoeshine boys and the bird sellers, the hawkers of cheap books and the witch doctors and the sellers of sweets who shouted over the din of the crowd, "Pineapple sweets for your sweetie, coconut candy is dandy, brown sugar loaf for your sugar." But indifferent to the uproar, she was captivated on the spot by a paper seller who was demonstrating magic inks, red inks with an ambiance of blood, inks of sad aspect for messages of condolence, phosphorescent inks for reading in the dark, invisible inks that revealed themselves in the light. She wanted all of them so she could amuse Florentino Arisa and astound him with her wit. But after several trials, she decided on a bottle of gold ink. Then she went to the candy seller sitting behind their big round jars and she bought six of each kind, pointing at the glass because she could not make herself heard above all. Over all the shouting. Six angel hair, six tinned milk, six sesame seed bars, six cassava pastries, six chocolate bars, six blanc mange, six tidbits of the queen, six of this and six of that, six of everything. And she tossed them into the maid's baskets with an irresistible grace and a complete detachment from the storm clouds of flies on the syrup, from the continual hullabaloo and the vapor of rancid sweat that reverberated in the deadly heat.
Why did you choose that?
For two reasons. I feel like I'm always chasing this one passage is from a much longer scene. She's in that marketplace forever, like for pages and pages and pages and pages. And I feel like I'm always chasing this scene somehow. The prose is so fantastic. It's in translation, obviously, but the magic of the past, the way our senses are activated, the way the history of the town is looped in, the dance between the closeness and the omniscience of the voice. It's a passage it's a chapter actually that conveys so much history and drama and humanity and life. You know, it's just bursting with life. These sentences are huge and the rhythm of them is astounding. And at the same time, all of it is building up to this turn. And that's sort of the second reason for my obsession with it. The passage is the first time that we're seeing Fermina Daza as the person she has become. And she's feeling it too. And this buildup leads us, surprisingly, but quite naturally, to the moment at the end of this chapter when Florentino Arisa, full of love and like lust and envy, he taps her on the shoulder in this moment in which he's sort of trying to remind her of their relationship, right? And he tells her, "This is no place for you." It's the first time they've seen each other since they broke up, and she sees him, and it breaks the spell of their attraction for her completely. She has realized in this passage in the market who she actually is, and that person is completely incompatible with the fantasy of this love affair that she's had since she was like a kid. And she just leaves him. She leaves him right there in the middle of the street. She says, "Please forget it." And that's the last thing she says to him. And I'm so interested in how emotional turns work and how they can work convincingly in fiction. The challenge is of bringing the reader on a journey of profound emotion and then how to sort of talk them into this emotional turn. And I think it's one of the most effective I've ever seen. And to this day, I think I read this when I was 14 for the first time and was just blown away by it. And over the years, I keep coming back and coming back to it for those reasons.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft or something you really like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to read, it's early on and it's a scene in which Syl is spending her first night in the Morningside with her mom. And sort of it's very quiet and she's used to these kind of habitats city blocks in cramped quarters that she's moved around in all her life, and this is her first time in this like old, quiet building. And she starts to get a little, urge. I hadn't felt the urge to make a protection for us in a long time. I was proud of that, not just because I had followed through on my decision to leave all that behind in Paraíso, but because doing so meant that I had managed to conceal the habit from my mother. For years, I had lived in fear that she would find the talismans I'd hidden around our flat, mistake them for trash, and throw them away without my knowledge, thus nullifying their effect, or worse, confront me about them. "What the hell is this?" she would say. I, having imagined this precise moment, would be ready. "Looks like your old perfume bottle. What's it doing behind the stove?" "I have no idea. I could have sworn I threw it out years ago." "Huh." This was meant to be my innocent, ignorant closer, because what else was there to say? "You actually did throw it out, Mama, but I dug it out of the trash because you really loved that perfume. And Signora Tesseretti said that I need at least 3 meaningful objects to make a good protection." Anyway, that was all behind me now. The Morningside could be as looming and empty and laden with unfamiliar noises as it liked. I didn't have 3 items to make a protection with anymore. I had deliberately thrown away the fragment of a photograph of a person I suspected might be my father, breaking the necessary triad. All I had left were a pair of scissors and the perfume bottle my mother had continued to spray in the vicinity of her neck long after it was empty, and I was determined that nothing would compel me to use them.
Tell me more about choosing that.
So I've written about OCD obliquely before, but I'd never written a character whose tendencies in it mirror my own quite as closely, or my own in that particular phase of life quite as closely as this particular ritual of Syl's does. And you know, having lived with it for years and found ways around it and in my own life, it was difficult to reinterrogate how that impulse would feel to a very young person who doesn't have the vocabulary of mental health. That was challenging. You know, she's isolated in this house, but she's in this building, but she's also isolated in her experience of the impulses she has to sort of calm her anxiety. And it was also challenging to sort of figure out how to portray belief, the sincere belief of a person, and then undercut her at the same time and show the reader that actually she's clearly convinced herself of something that may not be real and may not be good for her. But she's proud without the vocabulary of awareness of the way she's trying to deal with it now. And I think it's also, yeah, I think it was tricky to introduce the information and then also, again, not sneer at her young self from an older person's mentally trained point of view.
Where do you write?
I write here at the Teton County Library. I write in one of the armchairs by the fireplace.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I take a drive or I get on my bike. I like to be outdoors.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
My husband. He's also a novelist and he gives great feedback.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Poorly. I take it personally. I have a real sort of willful tendency to be like, "I'll show you," and so I think it urges me to write more.
And what is your favorite word?
Consequence. I love Q words. Words that. I love the look of the word consequence. I don't like consequences themselves. I like the look of the word and sort of the shape of it on the page. And I love a middle Q-U arrangement in a word.
Thank you so much for this beautiful conversation. I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. I had the loveliest time talking with you, and I'm such a fan of the show. And so I really appreciate the chance to come on and talk to you.
If you liked today's show with Taya Obrett, author of the novel The Morningside, check out my first interview with Taya. We talked about her novel Inland, writing a Western, superstition, and the academics of writing. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Tommy Orange, Steve Almond, and Adele Waldman. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft a dialogue on writing a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.